Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBBF Middleborough, WRRS Middleborough, WRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WBALLP FL, WDJM Framingham.
And we continue our newspaper coverage on this Friday, the 20th of February, 2026, with today's Boston Herald. We say hello today to Dottie and Joan.
Thank you, John. We'll start with one of the articles from today's Herald's front page. Academy troopers suspended with pay, by Rick Sobey. The four stateies facing charges over the death of trooper trainee Enrique Delgado Garcia will be suspended with pay, Mass State Police has announced. Lieutenant Jennifer Penton, Trooper Edwin Rodriguez, Trooper David Montañez, and Trooper Casey Lamont will get to keep their salary as they face involuntary manslaughter and other charges in connection with the recruit's boxing death. Penton has an annual pay rate of $141,807. Rodriguez and Montañez both have yearly rates of $100,486. And Lamont has an annual salary of $105,510. In accordance with Article 6 of its rules and regulations, the Massachusetts State Police convened duty status hearings to determine the duty status.
Good morning. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. LAB Radio is brought to you by the volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. This is Diane. I will be reading solo from The Sun, and if need be, I will move to the Tribune. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Okay, so today is Friday, May. Wow, where did that come from? February 20th. I guess I want the winter to be over. 2026. And the first article out on the front page is local housing projects to get a big boost. Major housing developments in the communities of Lowell, Westford, and Fitchburg are coming online in part due to a $140 million in state tax credits and subsidies, part of Governor Maura Healey's commitment to jumpstarting the Commonwealth's housing production. Healey said both the awards reflect the administration's push to increase housing supply in every region of Massachusetts, from downtowns to neighborhoods to smaller communities. The Affordable Homes Act gave us new tools to move faster and smarter. At this first round of commercial conversion, tax credits will help turn underused commercial properties into homes, bring new energy to our downtowns, and lower housing costs for residents. Healey said it at an event Tuesday in Pittsfield. The Healey-Driscoll administration funded $8.4 million from the new commercial conversion tax credit initiative to help communities transform empty or rundown commercial buildings into new homes. The program will support the creation of 339 homes. The initiative was created in the Affordable Homes Act, an initiative to increase housing production and invest in livable communities, not livable, which the governor signed in 2024. In addition, $139.5 million in low-income housing tax credits and subsidies through the Affordable Housing Development Grant Program will support the creation of 1,008 homes, including 903 affordable homes, of which 284 homes will be for extremely low-income households and those transitioning from homelessness. The awards, plural, support projects in downtowns and neighborhood centers where commercial buildings are underutilized and where new housing can help bring foot traffic, customers, and energy back to local business districts. Too many downtown buildings across Massachusetts are sitting dark and empty when they could be part of a solution to our housing shortage, Healy said in a statement. The Executive Office of Housing and Livable Communities is awarding the first ever CCTCI credits to five projects, including the Main Street Lofts at 280, which will receive $1,298,757 to convert a historic office building in downtown Fitchburg into rental housing that will include street-level retail. The project will also leverage historic tax credits. As part of the EOHLCS Affordable Housing Development Grant Program, the administration is also awarding a combination of federal and state low-income housing tax credits and EOHLC subsidy funds to 15 housing projects. In Lowell, the Revitalization Efforts Towards New Urbanism, a nonprofit affiliate of the Lowell Housing Authority, along with its development partner, Trinity Financial, was awarded low-income housing tax credit funds and state subsidies to bring the Merrimack Quarter Corridor development to life. The Lowell Housing Authority, a quasi-governmental agency, is the third largest housing authority in the Commonwealth. The LHA manages more than 3,000 federal and state housing units, serving the needs of more than 6,000 residents in low-income families, seniors, veterans, and people with disabilities. It is the largest provider of these services in Lowell, comprising 8% of the city's housing stock. The new construction of the Merrimack Corridor project will bring an additional 118 low-income units to Lowell's housing market. A majority of the units will be deeply affordable and are below 60% average median income, while the remaining units will be priced at or below 30% AMI. The buildings are designed to achieve passive house standards and meet Enterprise Green Communities criteria, ensuring that the residents live in energy-efficient homes. The Town Farm Road residents in Westford will provide 35 homes affordable to seniors at or below 60% AMI, including 10 of those homes at or below 30% AMI, on a site adjacent to a fire station and a food pantry. The housing project is a joint venture between SCG Development Partners and Choice Housing Opportunities for International and Community Endeavors. Economic reports indicate the Commonwealth needs to produce at least 200,000 new units by 2030 to keep up with the housing demand and to make sure people can stay and work in the state. The AHA legislation and 49 related initiatives support the production, preservation, and rehabilitation of more than 65,000 homes statewide over the next 5 years. Since taking office, Healy has focused on increasing housing production and lowering costs by speeding up the permitting process, converting state land into potential housing development, legalizing accessory dwelling units, and other initiatives like those announced Tuesday. We're grateful to the legislature for their partnership and for the developers who stepped up to build new housing through both of these programs, Healy said. Okay, crime out of Dracut. Dracut road rage dispute escalates into knife threat in Pelham, New Hampshire. Not good. Okay, a road rage dispute in Dracut spilled into Pelham, where police say one woman brandished a knife and slashed the other's tire. The Pelham Police Department said they were first called to Ace Discount Cigarettes at 28 Bridge Street at about 11:20 a.m. on January 8th for a report that a woman was being attacked in the parking lot by another woman, later identified as 38-year-old Lauren Sills. Officers learned the confrontation between the pair had started on the streets of Dracut before both drivers pulled into the business's parking lot. According to police, the victim went inside the store, and when she returned, Sills was waiting outside. Police released surveillance footage of the ensuing confrontation. In the video, the victim is seen standing near the back of her car, appearing to look into a bag when Sills approaches her aggressively and gets in her face, making physical contact. The quality of the footage makes it difficult to see a knife, but the victim is shown running from Sills as Sills pursues her with her arm drawn back in a threatening posture. With the victim out of the picture, Sills returns to the rear of the vehicle and is seen jabbing at the back driver's side tire before leaving the camera's view. Police said Sills fled southbound on Bridge Street. The Pelham Police Criminal Bureau took over the investigation, working with the Pelham Patrol Division, as well as police in Dracut and Lowell. Through that collaboration, authorities identified Sill as the suspect. Sills. On Thursday, Pelham detectives coordinated with Lowell Police Department to take Sills into custody at her residence as a fugitive from justice. She was extradited back across the border into New Hampshire and charged with criminally threatening with a deadly weapon, reckless conduct with a deadly weapon, attempted first-degree assault with a deadly weapon, simple assault, and criminal mischief. Sills was held on preventative detention and transported to Hillsborough County Jail. She is slated to be arraigned at 8 a.m. Friday in Salem District Court. Okay, suspend with pay for suspect troopers. The four cities facing charge over the death of trooper trainee Enrique Delgado Garcia will be suspended with pay, Mass State Police has announced. Lieutenant Jennifer Penton, Trooper Edwin Rodriguez, Trooper David Montanez, and Trooper Casey Lamont will get to keep their salary as they face involuntary manslaughter and other charges in connection with the recruit's boxing death. Penton has an annual pay rate of $141,807. Rodriguez and Montanez both have yearly rates of $100,486, and Lamont has an annual salary of $105,510. In accordance with Article 6 of its rules and regulations, the Massachusetts State Police convene duty status hearings to determine the duty status of four members who will face criminal charges as a result of the independent investigation into Trooper Enrique Delgado Garcia's death, Mass State Police said in a statement yesterday. The department reviewed all available information and determined the four individuals will be suspended with pay, State Police added. As in any disciplinary process, should additional information become available to the department through the judicial process, it may convene a subsequent duty status hearing to evaluate the new information. The four troopers attached to the Massachusetts State Police Academy will face involuntary manslaughter charges and also charges for causing serious bodily injury while participating in a training program involving physical exercise, according to the Attorney General's office. Penton is also facing a charge of perjury. The charges were announced last week at a press conference between Attorney General Andrea Campbell and Attorney David Meyer, who was hired to complete an independent investigation into Delgado Garcia's death. The four members of the state police were a part of the Academy's Defensive Tactics Unit. Delgado Garcia was knocked unconscious during a boxing exercise at the State Police Academy on September 12, 2024, and died the following day. During the press conference, Meyer said Delgado Garcia had been exhibiting concussion symptoms from a boxing match the day before he was knocked out on September 11th. Reckless conduct resulted in Enrique Delgado Garcia suffering concussion-like symptoms as the result of unauthorized, unapproved, and unsupervised boxing-related sparring exercises that occurred during the academy training activities. Penton, the supervisor of the unit, will also face a perjury charge for allegedly providing false statements to a grand jury about when she initially knew of Delgado Garcia's concussion symptoms. A special statewide grand jury indicted the state police officers, who have not been arrested but will be issued summons to be arraigned at a later date. The grand jury heard from 150 witnesses, the vast majority state police officers, and examined 350 exhibits. While the grand jury evidence concluded with charges for the four officers. It did not show that charges would be brought against the Academy's command staff, Mayer said. There's no evidence that Enrique Delgado Garcia was targeted in any way, he added. There is no evidence that anyone, Academy staff, fellow trainees, or others, harbored any personal animosity towards Enrique Delgado Garcia. Campbell had appointed Meyer as an independent investigator because of a conflict of interest with the Worcester County District Attorney's Office. Delgado Garcia began his career in public service as a witness advocate for the office. State Police Colonel Jeffrey Noble has noted that Mass State Police has taken steps to reform the agency since the trooper trainee's death, including initiating an independent review by the International Association of Chiefs of Police and expanding supports for recruits. Excuse me. Lexington Minutemen are fighting each other. Usually the Lexington Minutemen fight, or pretend to fight, the British on the battlefield every year at the commemoration of the first fight of the American Revolution. But right now, some of them are fighting each other in the courtroom. The leader of the group of historical reenactors is suing two other members over allegations of defamation, according to a public complaint. But the defendants said they have proof of their accusations. Stephen Cole, the captain of the Minutemen, filed the suit in Middlesex Superior Court against his fellow members Robert Rowell and John Nichols after they brought allegations of Cole's fraud and financial troubles to other leaders in the group. According to the complaint, Rowell accused Cole of defrauding local residents through his contracting business and the Lexington Minuteman organization in January 3rd emailed to past captain's committee of LMM. Rowell said that he uncovered information about Cole's past with the assistance of my attorney and John Nichols, according to the complaint. The email stated the other members of the organization were blowing money at Cole's command, the complaint said. Cole said that those claims were false. The email was designed to give the reader the impression that the plaintiff is a lifelong criminal who cannot be trusted in leadership positions such as the one he holds with LMM, the suit stated. As a local contractor and a leader of the group, Cole said the accusations have and will continue to hurt his reputation and cause emotional and financial harm. Cole said that the dispute with Rowell and Nicholas began after the two were suspended from the agency for unspecified reasons last year. Despite the fact that it was not Cole who reported defendants to the board and that Cole did not act unilaterally in suspending Rowell, defendant Rowell has improperly and incorrectly accused plaintiff of being the driving force of the campaign against Rowell, his complaint states. But Rowell and Nichols argued in an answer to Cole's complaint that they were only suspended after raising concerns about Cole's actions, including unauthorized spending and contractual approvals. As to the veracity of the email, their response said the actual, complete, and accurate language of the January 3rd email speaks for itself. They denied that the allegations were false, although they noted some of these statements are clearly opinions. Neither filing shares the complete language of the aforementioned email. To support their claim, the defendants included court documents from judgments against Cole in the amount of $11,000 and almost $450,000 plus interest. Their answer also includes objections from the awardees to a pleading in Cole's bankruptcy case. The debtor is not an honest person, wrote Kenneth Virgil, a former friend of Cole's, who won the $450,000 judgment against Cole. Virgil claimed in his objection that Cole borrowed money from him for a project that didn't exist. Truth is an absolute defense to a claim for defamation and raising concerns about matters of public interest, particularly the stewardship of a nonprofit corporation soliciting charitable funds. Is it at the heart of our democracy? The defendant wrote in their response. As this litigation will easily reveal, Cole's complaint is a transparent effort to suppress truthful speech about matters of undeniable public interest. Cole is seeking damages, lawyer's fees, and a declaration that he did not violate fiduciary duties to LMM, nor engage in fraud or conspiracy to commit fraud within LMM. He is also asking the court to stop the defendants from reaching out to third parties or posting about Cole on social media. A court date for the case has not yet been set. Okay, out of Rhode Island, bystanders jump into action to end the carnage. Providence, Rhode Island. Sitting in the stands at a hockey game, Michael Black heard what he thought was popping balloons before quickly realizing it was gunfire. A dozen of people rushed out of the Rhode Island arena. Black told his wife to run, and then lunge towards the shooter's handgun. Black managed to get his left hand caught in the chamber of Robert Dorgan's gun, jamming it and then briefly attempting to hold Dorgan down. But Dorgan, a former bodybuilding, hoisted Black into the air before at least two other bystanders rushed over to subdue the shooter. One of them could be seen on video putting Dorgan in a chokehold. Dorgan fell to the ground with Black on top of him. The shooter died from a self-inflicted gunshot after pulling out a second gun as the two locked eyes. Black never heard Dorgan say a word. The first thought was the safety of my wife, and the second thought was because the bullets were coming out was too focused on the gun, Black said. Get the gun and then subdue the shooter. Pawtucket police have said the shooter began the behind the deadly ice rink tragedy on Monday was Robert Dorgan, who also went by Roberta Esposito and Roberta Durango. Dorgan's ex-wife, Rhonda Dorgan, and adult son, Aiden Dorgan, were killed in the shooting, and three others were injured. Rhonda Dorgan's parents, Linda and Gerald Dorgan, and a family friend, Tommaso Garuso, all of whom remained in critical condition Wednesday. Pawtucket police say the group of courageous citizens who rushed to intervene in the attack undoubtedly prevented further injury and increased the chances of survival for the injured. Along with Black, Robert Rattini and Ryan Cordiero were both credited as subduing the suspect. Separately, Chris Labrizi and Glenn Nordawi, both retired Rhode Island firefighters and EMTs, and nurse Miriam Rattini provided first aid in the immediate aftermath. I look at this as being fortunate, saddened tremendously in the loss, but fortunate that a small group of people could make a difference, Black said in a Zoom interview Thursday from South Carolina, where he was on a college visit with his son. Authorities have not directly said that Dorgan was a transgender and have said questions around Dorgan's gender identity are not relevant to their investigation surrounding the case. However, court records from Dorgan's past show that gender identity was at least one of the contributing factors to Dorgan's wife filing for divorce in 2020 after nearly 30 years of marriage. Dorgan's ex account mentioned being transgender and sharing far-right ideologies. Black said Dorgan was walking down rows of seats determined to shoot more people. As he pinned the shooter's head with his knee, Black said he noticed Dorgan had additional magazine holdings, quite a few bullets. With Dorgan dead, other bystanders rushed to provide treatment for the five people who had been shot and were laying between the bleachers. Blood was everywhere. Police arrived within minutes, and Black, with his injured hand, was escorted outside in the parking lot where he reunited with his wife. My wife saw me and she ran underneath the yellow tape, kind of grabbed me from behind, and we gave a big hug, Black said. She said, I heard you helped with the shooter, and says, what's all the blood? I said, I got my hand caught in the gun. And then she said, honey, I don't know whether I should be proud of you, but I'm pissed off at you for putting yourself in that situation. As he was sitting in the hospital getting treatment on his injured hand, Black recalled the nurse calling him a hero, a label that repeatedly has been applied to all three bystanders in recent days. I said, I don't feel like I'm a hero right now, Black said. I looked up and I was feeling for the family, so I started getting some tears in my eyes, and then she got tears in her eyes too. It was just a moment of decompression at that point. Wow. Okay. Pints for Purpose brings Sun Santa to nearly $150,000. That's cool. $150,000. The Santa Fund's elves are still busy tallying up all of the generous donations the community provided to help local families in need this holiday season. And we're happy to report that a new fundraising event has helped us near a milestone amount. The inaugural Pints for a Purpose event held at the Old Court on December 13th raised $17,552.60, nearly double its $10,000 goal, bringing Santa close to $150 raised this winter. We thank event organizers Councillor Dan Rourke, Lowell School Committee member Danielle McFadden, Pride Star Trinity EMS Senior Vice President of Marketing and Public Relations, Chris Dick, and all of those who made this new event a resounding success. With gratitude, here are the contributors to the event. Pride Star EMS Incorporated in Lowell gave $2,500. Markley Group of Boston, $2,500. North Bank and Trust Company of Woburn, $1,000. Committee to Elect Dan Rourke, Lowell, $900. Commonwealth Property Insurance, LLC, Chelmsford, $650. Committee to Elect Thomas Golden, Jr., Lowell, $500, twice. Lowell and Noel Cregan, Jr., of Lowell, $500. Christopher Feria of Chelmsford, $500. The Old Court, Lowell, $500. VMAC Removal, LLC, Lowell, $500. We Share a Common Thread Foundation, Lowell, $500. Committee to Elect Corey Blancher, Lowell, $450. Committee to Elect Kim Scott, Lowell, $450. Boughton Appraisals Incorporated, $400. Boughton Appraisals Incorporated, $250. DeRosa Properties, LLC, Lowell, $250. O'Hearn Insurance, Lowell, $250. David Kelleher, Tewksbury, $206. Leo Cregan Sr. of Lowell, $200. William and Martha Martin of Lowell, $200. Jim and Laurel Rivard, Lowell, $200. Chris and Elizabeth Dick of Tewksbury, $154.50. Matthew Lockyer of Lowell, $103. Sarah Carvalho, $100. John and Linda Chamali of Chelmsford, $100. Committee to Elect Kim Scott, $100. Committee to Elect Rita Mercier, $100. Kevin Coughlin of Westford, $100. Robert Cox of Drake, $100. Erica and Angela Gitzcher, I think, of Lowell, $100. Mitch and Katie Guzajuk of Dunstable, $100. David Keene of Lowell, $100. Angela McCarthy of Lowell, $100. John Moynihan of Lowell, $100. Steve Panagotakos of Lowell, $100. Gregory Pappas of Drake at $100. Doris and Ronald Richards of Lowell, $100. William and Joyce Samaras of Lowell, $100. Sam Bilmag Properties, LLC of Lowell, $100. Leo and Cheryl Sheridan of Lowell, $100. Paul Belly and Chris Brunel of Lowell, $95. Anonymous, $75. Lauren Betts of North Chelmsford, $51.50. Hidden Battles Foundation, Drake at $51.50. Anonymous, $50. Sean Callahan of Just Massachusetts, $50. Committee to Elect Sakari Chu of Lowell, $50. Andy and Isling Daly, $50. Dan Dupre, $50. Rodney Elliott, $50. Christian Anthony Felitra of Lowell, $50. Denise and Eugene Finn of Lowell, $50. Robert Gignac of Lowell, $50. Sam Moss of Lowell, $50. Ryan Rourke and Megan Stebbins of Lowell, $50. Kevin and Terry Morrissey, $50. Natine and Manuda Patal of Lowell, $50. Kathleen and Eileen Trott of Lowell, $50. Paul Yem of Lowell, $50. Jamie Lemire of Lowell, $25.75. Kevin Specht of Lowell, $25.75. Anonymous, all $25 each. Peter Courier, $25. Dominic Lay of Lowell, $25. Courtney LaRose of Lowell, $25. Sarah Olander of doesn't say, $25. Kristen Shaver of Lowell, $25. Autumn Clearner of Lowell, $20.60. Three anonymouses each at $20 for a grand total of $17,552.60. All right. That was a good amount of money for the Santa Fund. $4,000 energy grant to Lowell's House of Hope. Hold on for 1 second. Citizens Energy Shelter Winter Assistance Program helps human service providers. Out of Lowell. Taking care of the organizations that take care of people they serve was the purpose of an energy affordability announcement event Wednesday at Lowell's House of Hope, which was attended by Governor Maura Healey. The nonprofit received $4,000 from Citizens Energy Corps, through its Shelter Winter Assistance Program to help pay the heating cost at its family shelter on Fletcher Street in the city's Acre neighborhood. The shelter serves 31 families. The Shelter Winter Assistance Program provides critical heating assistance to shelters and facilities serving individuals and families experiencing homelessness. This year's funding will help ensure these organizations can continue to provide safe, warm spaces during the coldest months while focusing their resources on essential, services. Executive Director Julie Lemire said feeling safe and cared for is the first step in building stability and independence for the House of Hope clients. Support like this not only keeps our buildings heated, it strengthens our ability to provide the wraparound services that help people gain independence and hope, she said to Citizens Energy Corp President Joe Kennedy III at the event. Lemire said that since 1997, the program has awarded more than $100,000 to House of Hope. Thank you, Citizens Energy, for the impact you have, she said. You show up for people, and that's what makes the difference. The morning event was attended by Governor Healey, Secretary of Energy and Environmental Affairs Rebecca Tepper, Lowell Mayor Eric Gitscher, Vice Mayor Vesna Known, City Council Corey Robinson, State Representatives Vanna Howard, Rodney Elliott, and Tara Honk, and Lowell City Manager Tom Golden, as well as client staff and supporters of the nonprofit. Healey said her administration's been focused on reducing energy bills and stopping major rate hikes, part of the energy affordability agenda she mentioned during a speech in late February to the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce. We know families are struggling, Healey said. That's why House of Hope is so important. We continue to make investments in the people in the state and making life more affordable for them. Healey's administration secured rebates for Massachusetts ratepayers. Consumers will see 25% off their electric bill and 10% off their gas bill. It's not everything, but it's a start, Healey said. In addition to opposing rate hikes, Healey said she has filed legislation to bring more energy to the Commonwealth at a cheaper price, as well as removing unnecessary charges from ratepayers' bills. We think it's going to save ratepayers $13 billion, the governor said. Healey said her administration has been focused on upgrading energy infrastructure, such as transmission lines, wires, and poles that deliver the state's energy to private and public customers. The governor called partnerships with companies like Citizens Energy smart. With the legislation that I've filed, we will make it easier for organizations like Citizens Energy to invest in these projects and send these profits right back to the people who pay the bills, Healey said. Still, some people will fall through the cracks, and organizations like House of Hope are there to help catch them. But to do so, Kennedy said, they need to be able to afford the same energy that they are providing to their clients through their services and programs. We know that the cost of energy can be one of the biggest challenges facing families, Kennedy said. We've spent decades developing practical solutions to help lower energy bills, strengthen critical infrastructures, and support our communities while funding charitable programs to those who need it most. Citizens Energy supports, plural, more than 120 facilities across Massachusetts and Rhode Island. We've donated $10 million to homeless shelters and food pantries across our communities, Kennedy said. By helping to cover heating costs, the Citizens Energy Program allows shelters and service providers to redirect their resources to health care, job training, education, and permanent housing support programs. Healey closed the event by making what she called a public service announcement on energy bills, noting that some consumers may be eligible for low-income discounts from their utility companies. We are working every day to drive down energy costs in Massachusetts, Healey said. Okay. The Massachusetts Alliance of Portuguese Speakers is expanding its housing assistance services in Greater Boston, thanks to a $50,000 annual grant for up to 3 years from Liberty Mutual Insurance. The grant awarded in December through Liberty Mutual Foundation's Housing Stability Initiative will enable the organization to serve an additional 160 low-income community members each year, helping them access stable housing as well as educational and employment resources. We are very grateful for this new partnership with Liberty Mutual to expand our efforts to connect vulnerable families in our communities to these crucial resources. MAP CEO Paulo Pinto said, ensuring that our communities have access to safe, dignified living conditions is an essential part of our mission, and it is especially gratifying to see private sector partners like the Liberty Mutual Foundation join in that effort. MAP's Immigration Integration Services assists thousands of community members each year with personalized assistance around housing, employment, nutrition, and fuel assistance, access to other public benefits, as well as assistance with health insurance and healthcare enrollment, and other essential social services. The nonprofit estimates that the grant will prevent 50 evictions per year and assist 80 people experiencing homelessness and gaining access to basic services. MAPS has served the Portuguese-speaking communities and immigrants from all backgrounds throughout Massachusetts since 1970, supporting almost 28,000 people in fiscal 2025. The organization offers free health and social services through its 6 offices in Cambridge, Somerville, Everett, Dorchester, Lowell, and Framingham. Out of Lowell, learn how to access and navigate artificial intelligence programs during an AI Skills That Matter, an introduction workshop on Saturday, February 21st from 12:30 to 4:30 in the ground floor community room meeting of the Pollard Memorial Library, 401 Merrimack Street. Hands-on practice will be included, and people of all skill levels are welcomed. Participants are encouraged to bring a laptop and open a free AI account through ChatGPT, Gemini, or any other AI platform. Registration is required at lowellibrary.org/events. For more information, call 978-674-4120. Out of Lowell, save the date. Sharps and Medication Disposal Day. The city's health department is sponsoring an unwanted medication and sharps disposal day on Saturday, March 7th from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Senior Center, located at 276 Broadway Street. Prescriptions and over-the-counter medications are accepted, as are inhalers, EpiPens, nasal sprays, lancets, and Narcan. All pill medications must be in plastic bags, no bottles, and sharps must be in a puncture-proof container. Residential disposal only, no commercial disposal. Call the Lowell Health Department for any discarded needles found in parks, fields, or other public areas. To have those syringes removed, call 978-674-1049. On nights and weekends, call the non-emergency police line at 978-937-3200. The health department and the city of Lowell provide various ways to properly dispose of sharps. Sharps should never be thrown loosely into the trash, recycling, or toilet, as they are safety risks to the public sanitation workers. Sharps that retract after use or are very small should be disposed of like all other sharps. Sharps disposal kiosks are located at Lowell's Health Department, 107 Merrimack Street, 4th floor, the Lowell Senior Center, 276 Broadway Street, Lowell Community Health Center, 161 Jackson Street, and Riverbend, 101 Jackson Street, 2nd floor. For more information, call 978-674-4304. Okay, get the shovels out. Yet another round of snow is on the way. A winter storm is expected to bring a mix of snow, rain, and freezing rain to the region today into Saturday before all focus turns to a potential coastal storm. The National Weather Service has issued a winter weather advisory for today to Saturday across much of Massachusetts. Up to 6 inches of snow is possible in northern Mass, while around 2 to 3 inches of snow is expected in the Boston area. Plan on slippery road conditions. The hazardous conditions could impact Friday evening's commute. NWS Boston wrote in its advisory, slow down and use caution while traveling. Precipitation breaks out in far western New England after the morning commute and gradually spreads northeast into the afternoon. Areas north of the Mass Pike and into the Merrimack Valley, North Shore, should remain mostly snow for the duration of the event, where the greatest accumulations of wet snow are forecasted, 3 to 5 inches of snow with 6 inches in spots along the New Hampshire border. For the Boston area and South Shore, it should start as rain mixed with ice pellets. Then this evening, a transition from a wintry mix to snow is expected. Meanwhile, meteorologists are keeping a close eye on a coastal storm for the end of the weekend. A variety of outcomes remain on the table, with the system still a few days away. Coastal storm late night Sunday into Monday, more than likely to miss or just brush southern New England, but too soon to rule out a more higher impact outcome. Even with further offshore paths, it will likely lead to gusty winds and increased waves on the water, as well as potential for ocean-enhanced snow showers over southeast Massachusetts, NWS Boston added. As we get into the range of high-resolution guidance, we shall have a better idea over the next 24 to 36 hours. Okay, we're going to skip over. Okay. Former Prince Andrew arrested and held for hours on suspicion of misconduct over his ties to Epstein. Out of London, the former Prince Andrew was arrested and held for hours by British police Thursday on suspicion of misconduct in public office related to his links to Jeffrey Epstein, an extraordinary move in a country where authorities once sought to shield the royal family from embarrassment. It was the first time in nearly four centuries that a senior British royal was placed under arrest, and it has underscored how deference to the monarchy has eroded in recent years. King Charles III, whose late mother lived by the motto, never complain, never explain, took the unusual step of issuing a statement on the arrest of his brother, now known as Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. Let me state clearly, the law must take its course, the king said. As this process continues, it would not be right for me to comment further on this matter. The Thames Valley Police Force said Mountbatten Windsor was released Thursday evening, about 11 hours after he was detained at his home in eastern England. He was photographed in a car leaving the police station near the Royal Sandringham Estate. Police said he was released under investigation, meaning he has neither been charged nor exonerated. The police force, which covers areas west of London, including Mountbatten Windsor's former home, said Thursday that a man in his 60s from Norfolk has been arrested and was in custody. Police did not identify the suspect, in line with standard procedures in Britain. Mountbatten Windsor, 66, moved to the King's private estate in Norfolk after he was evicted from his longtime home near Windsor Castle earlier this month. Police previously said they were assessing reports that Mountbatten Windsor sent trade information to Epstein, a wealthy investor and convicted sex offender, in 2010, when the former prince was Britain's special envoy for international trade. Correspondence between the two men was released by the U.S. Justice Department late last month, along with millions of pages of documents from the American investigation into Epstein. Following a thorough assessment, we have now opened an investigation into this allegation of misconduct in public office, Assistant Chief Constable Oliver Wright said in a statement. Excuse me for a minute, I need to cough. Okay. Police search Mountbatten Windsor's Sandringham home and his former residence at Royal Lodge in Windsor. Earlier in the day, pictures circulating circulated online that appeared to show unmarked police cars at Wood Farm, Mountbatten Winder's home at Sendengrim, with plainclothes officers gathering outside. Mountbatten Windsor has consistently denied any wrongdoing in his association with Epstein. The allegations being investigated Thursday were separate from those made by Virginia Guaffrey, who claimed that she was trafficked to Britain to have sex with the prince in 2001 when she was just 17. Guaffrey died by suicide last year. Still, Guaffrey's sister-in-law, Amanda Roberts, said that she was overjoyed when she got a phone call at 3 a.m. telling her the news of the arrest. But those feelings of elation were quickly complicated by the realization that she couldn't share the feelings of vindication with Guaffrey. "We can't tell her how much we love her and that everything that she was doing was not in vain," Roberts added tearfully. Sky Roberts, Guaffrey's brother, added that he thinks his sister would be celebrating the small victory along with them if she was still alive, but would be pushing for more accountability in both the United Kingdom and the United States based on the files. "We need to unmask the co-conspirators and potential predators, and then we need to see indictments," Amanda Roberts said. "This is the most spectacular fall from grace for a member of the royal family in modern times," said Craig Prescott, a royal expert at Royal Holloway University of London, who compared it in severity to the crisis sparked by Edward VIII's abdication to marry American divorcee Wallis Simpson. "And may it not be over yet," Prescott added. Thursday's arrest came a day after the National Police Chiefs Council said it had created a group to assist forces across the UK, that are assessing whether Epstein and his associates committed crimes in Britain. In addition to the concerns about Mountbatten Windsor's correspondence, documents released by the US suggest Epstein may have used his private jet to traffic women to and from Britain. U.S. President Donald Trump said the arrest was a shame and very sad. "I think it's so bad for the royal family," he told reporters in Washington. The documents also rocketed British politics. Prime Minister Keir Starmer, Prime Minister Keir Starmer had to fight off questions about his judgment after the papers revealed that Peter Mendelssohn, the man who he appointed ambassador to the U.S., had a longer and closer relationship with Epstein than was previously disclosed. London's Metropolitan Police Service has said it is investigating allegations of misconduct in public office related to Mendelssohn's own correspondence with Epstein. Mendelssohn was fired as ambassador to the U.S. in September. But it is Mountbatten Windsor's relationship with Epstein that brought the scandal to the doors of Buckingham Palace and threatened to undermine support for the monarchy. Last royal arrest was in the 1640s. The last time a senior British royal was arrested was almost 400 years ago, during the reign of King Charles I, that saw a growing power struggle between the Crown and Parliament. After the King attempted to arrest lawmakers in the House of Commons in 1642, hostilities erupted in the English Civil War, which ended with the victory for the parliamentary force of Oliver Cromwell. Charles the First was arrested, tried, convicted of high treason, and beheaded in 1649. Concerns about Mountbatten Windsor's link to Epstein have dogged the royal family for more than a decade. The late Queen Elizabeth II forced her second son to give up royal duties and end his charitable work in 2019 after he tried to explain away his friendship with Epstein during a catastrophic interview with the BBC. But as concern mounted about the Epstein files might reveal, the King moved aggressively to insulate the royal family from the fallout. Since October, Charles has stripped his younger brother of the right to be called prince, forced him to move out of the royal estate he occupied for more than 20 years, and issued a public statement supporting the women and girls abused by Epstein. Last week, the palace said it was ready to cooperate with police investigating Mountbatten Windsor. Charles was forced to act after Mountbatten Winder's correspondence with Epstein torpedoed the former prince's claim that he severed ties with the financier after Epstein's 2008 conviction from soliciting a minor for prostitution. Instead, emails between the two men show Epstein offering to arrange a date between Mountbatten Windsor and a young Russian woman in 2010, and then Prince inviting Epstein to dinner at Buckingham Palace. Additional correspondence appears to show Mountbatten Windsor sending Epstein reports from a two-week tour of Southeast Asia that he undertook in 2010 as Britain's trade envoy. Police did not release details of Mountbatten Windsor's questioning at the small-town police station in Aslasham near Sandringham. Danny Shaw, an expert on law enforcement in the UK, told the BBC that the former prince would likely be placed in a cell in a custody suite with just a bed and a toilet, where he will wait until his police interview. There will be no special treatment for him, Shaw said. Okay, what's next? White House pressure leads university to cut ties with nonprofits that help minorities. I'm going to take a sip of water. The Trump administration said Thursday its campaign to end diversity programs in higher education has led dozens of universities to cut ties with an organization known as the PhD Project, which helps racial minorities earn doctorate degrees. The PhD Project was a little-known nonprofit group until it caught the attention of conservative strategists last year and became the focus of an investigation by the U.S. Department of Education. The Republican administration says school diversity programs often exclude white and Asian American students. The investigation, opened in March of 2025, has resulted in 31 universities agreeing to end partnerships with the group, the department's Office for Civil Rights said Thursday. Negotiations are continuing with 14 additional schools, it said. The department said in its statement that the PhD Project unlawfully limits eligibility based on the race of participants and that institutions partnering with it violated the Title VI Act of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which bars discrimination on the basis of race, color, or national origin in education programs and activities that receive federal money. This is the Trump effect in action. Institutions of higher education are agreeing to cut ties with discriminatory organizations, recommitting themselves to abiding by federal law and restoring equality of opportunity on campuses across the nation, Education Secretary Linda McMahon said. Many of the schools promptly cut ties with the PhD program after the investigation was opened in order to avoid entanglements with the administration. It had undertaken the inquiries after warning schools they could lose federal money over race-based preferences. The PhD Project is one of many nonprofits that helps underrepresented groups gain access to higher education. The PhD Project was founded with the goal of providing more role models in the front of business classrooms, and this remains our goal today, the organization said in a statement Thursday. The website says it has helped more than 1,500 members earn their doctorate degree. The group of 31 colleges listed by the department included major public research universities such as Arizona State, Ohio State, and the University of Michigan, along with prestigious private schools like Yale, Duke, and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. MIT, like many of the schools cited in the investigation, had paid the PhD Project a nominal fee to participate in the group's university fairs or conferences, allowing MIT to send representatives to answer questions about attending their school, spokesperson Kimberly Allen said. MIT informed the government in April of 2025 it had ended its participation in such conferences and was notified months later that the Office for Civil Rights had found it in violation of Title VI. The school signed a resolution agreement with the department about a week ago to resolve the matter, but explicitly did not admit any liability, wrongdoing, or violation of any law or regulation, Allen said. The University of North Dakota said it too, promptly ended its membership with the PDH product project 2 weeks after the investigation was announced last year. The university became a member of the PhD project. I'm dyslexic, I apologize, to have access to the PhD project's member directory and applicant database to be able to recruit a larger pool of qualified applicants for faculty positions, spokesperson David Dodd said in a statement. The University of Utah said it had a table at annual conferences hosted by the nonprofit in 2024-25 school year and two previous years. It cut ties with the project in October after settling with the department, university spokesperson Rebecca Walsh said. Out of 170 PhD students admitted to Utah's business school over the past 14 years, just two were involved through the PhD project, Walsh said. The Education Department said that all of the 31 universities have also agreed to review partnerships with other organizations to identify any that violate Title VI by restricting participation based on race. The administration has targeted a wide range of practices that it has labeled as diversity, equity, and inclusion. The Associated Press's education coverage receives financial support from multiple private foundations. AP is solely responsible for all content. Find AP Standards for Working with Philanthropies, a list of supporters and funded coverage areas at ap.org. Okay, where are we? A look at the U.S. military assets in the Middle East. Do I want to read this? This isn't too long. Okay. Washington. The Pentagon is sending the largest force of American warships and aircrafts to the Middle East in decades, including two aircraft carrier strike groups, as President Donald Trump warns of possible military action against Iran if talks over its nuclear program fall apart. It's proven to be, over the years, not easy to make a meaningful deal with Iran, and we have to make a meaningful deal, Trump said Thursday. Otherwise, bad things happen. Trump likely will have a host of military options, which could include surgical attacks on Iran's air defenses or strikes focused on Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, experts say. But they warn that Iran could retaliate in ways it hadn't following attacks last year by the U.S. or Israel, potentially risking American lives and sparking a regional war. It will be very hard for the Trump administration to do a one-and-done attack, kind of attack in Iran this time around, said Ali Vaez, an Iranian expert at the International Crisis Group, because the Iranians would respond in a way that would make all-out conflict inevitable. Trump has repeatedly threatened to use force to compel Iran to agree to constrain its nuclear program and earlier over Tehran's bloody crackdown on nationwide protests. Trump also said last week that a change in power, in Iran would be the best thing that could happen. The aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln and three guided missile destroyers have been in the Arabian Sea since the end of January after being redirected from the South China Sea. The strike group, which brought roughly 5,700 additional service members to the region, bolstered the smaller force of a few destroyers and three littoral combat ships that were already in the region. 2 weeks later, Trump ordered the world's largest aircraft carrier, the USS Gerald Ford, along with three destroyers and more than 5,000 more service members to head to the region. This will bring the Navy's presence in the region to 14 ships, and it will dwarf the 11-ship fleet that was until the Ford's departure stationed in the Caribbean Sea. Numerous additional U.S. fighter jets and support aircrafts also have been touched down in the Middle East. Dozens of fighter jets, including F-35s, F-22s, F-15s, and F-16s, left bases in the U.S. and Europe and were spotted heading to the Middle East by the Military Air Tracking Alliance, a team of 30 open-source analysts that routinely analyze military and government flight activity. The team say it had also tracked more than 85 fuel tankers and over 170 cargo planes heading in the region in mid-February. Staffan Watkins, a researcher based in Canada and a member of the MATA, said he also has tracked support aircraft like six of the military's early warning E-3 aircraft head to a base in Saudi Arabia. Those aircrafts are key for coordinating operations with a large number of aircraft. The massive wave was preceded weeks prior by the arrival of Air Force F-15E Strike Eagles. U.S. Central Command said on a social media that the fighter jet enhances combat readiness and promotes regional security and stability. At the time, analysts of the flight track data also noticed dozens of U.S. military cargo planes heading to the region. The activity is similar to last year when the U.S. moved into air defense hardware like a Patriot missile system in anticipation of an Iranian counterattack following the June bombing of three key nuclear sites. Iran launched over a dozen missiles at Al-Udeid Air Base in Qatar days after the strikes. Seth Jones, a defense expert at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, said it's important to note that the U.S. is not deploying a major ground force. The U.S. deployed more than 500,000 troops during Operation Desert Storm in the early 1990s and roughly 2,500 American forces in Iraq in 2003. So there are substantial limits to the force package, he said, of the current military assets in the region. The U.S. military buildup is technically the region's largest since the 2003 invasion of Iraq, even though the resources moved from the war dwarfed current assets, said Michael O'Hanlon, a defense and foreign policy analyst at the Brookings Institution. O'Hanlon said the U.S. could simply use long-range B-2 bombers, as it had in June, if it wanted only to strike what's left of Iran's nuclear program. The forces in place now are clearly designed for attacking targets in Iran and defending against retaliation. Many likely expect Iran to keep firing drones and cruise missiles back at Israel and America bases in regard to almost anything we might do, O'Hanlon said. But he said Iran could go bigger and broader, especially if its leadership feels targeted. Vaez, the Iran expert at the International Crisis Group, said Iran is unlikely to limit its response as it did after the U.S. struck its nuclear facilities in June. Iran has signaled when and how it would retaliate with the attack on the military base in Qatar, allowing American and Qatari air defense to be ready and doing little damage. They have now come to the conclusion that the only way they can stop the cycle is to draw blood and to inflict significant harm on the U.S. and Israel, even if that comes at a very high price for themselves, Vaez said. Benam Bentaleblou, an analyst at the Washington-based Foundation for Defense of Democracies, said Iran is still believed to have ballistic missiles that can strike its enemies in the region. The Islamic Republic may think that would be a deterrent to Trump, whereas in reality, that might be an inducement to move the president from a limited operation into a larger one, said Taliblu, whose think tank has long been critical of Iran and has been sanctioned by Tehran. All right, and on that very complicated note, I'm going to take a morning break. I will return, and thank you for listening thus far.
10 to 15 days, pretty much maximum. Trump's top national security advisors met in the Situation Room on Wednesday to discuss the Iran situation, and they were told that the U.S. forces that have been deployed to the region will all be in place by mid-March, a U.S. official familiar with the issue said. The administration wants it known, officials said, that they are building combat power in the region. The president also has publicly raised the possibility of toppling Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, a longtime U.S. adversary, suggesting last week that it would be the best thing that could happen if Iran ends up with new leaders. Still, it is unclear whether Trump has approved military action.
One consideration, some noted, is the ongoing Winter Olympics, which concludes Sunday in Italy. The United States, backed by ally Israel, would have an overwhelming advantage militarily over Iran, said Daniel B. Shapiro, a former U.S. ambassador to Israel and senior Pentagon official during the Biden administration. The warships in or nearing the Middle East join a sprawling array of combat power already in position, including dozens of fighter jets, air defense capabilities, and other weapons. But a major conflict with Iran poses grave risks, Shapiro said, including ballistic missiles capable of killing U.S. troops in the region, a network of proxy forces across the Middle East that could quickly turn any attack into a far wider and deadlier war, and the potential for significant disruption to maritime shipping and the global oil market. They'll definitely take terrible damage from combined U.S.-Israeli strikes, said Shapiro, a distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council, referring to Iran, but that doesn't mean it ends quickly or clean, and they do have some ability to impose some costs in the other direction. Some U.S. troops are expected to be withdrawn from bases in the Middle East if the Pentagon makes final preparations for a fight, two people familiar with the matter said. Some will be told to stay and protect their installations from potential attack, while others are expected to move to safety in Europe or the United States, one of the officials said. The Pentagon has taken similar precautions in the past. The military buildup coincides with recent meetings between U.S. and Iranian officials aimed at negotiating changes to Tehran's nuclear program. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt told reporters this week that the two sides had made a little bit of progress, but were still very far apart on some issues. Iranian officials, she added, are expected to come back to us with some more detail in the next couple of weeks. It is unclear if Trump is willing to wait that long. Regional diplomats initially thought that the Trump administration's military pressure on Iran was meant to push Tehran to offer greater concessions in those negotiations, according to a European diplomat briefed on the Iran talks. But after the most recent talks concluded Tuesday in Geneva, diplomats now believe that Iran is not prepared to budge from its core positions, including its right to enrich uranium. The Iranians were planning to drown them in technicalities and delay substance, the diplomat said. While a more traditional approach would have built on the dialogue, Trump does not have the patience. The U.S. military buildup initially was reassuring to some officials in the region, according to this diplomat, but the indications that the Trump administration is preparing for an extended conflict have become deeply concerning. Some actors may have favored targeted strikes to add pressure on Iran, said the diplomat, referring to officials from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. But an extended conflict will be bloody, and it could bring more countries, either deliberately or by miscalculation, into the war. Secretary of State Marco Rubio plans to travel to Israel on February 28 to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, a State Department official said. The trip would be aimed at keeping Netanyahu abreast of the status of U.S.-Iran negotiations, the official said, but it does not preclude the Pentagon from launching strikes first. In summer, the U.S. struck Iran's nuclear facilities, even as the president's top diplomats had diplomatic meetings with Iranian counterparts on the books. Netanyahu is eager for the United States to launch a major attack on Iran, and in a speech Sunday, he put forward his own conditions for any U.S. agreement with Tehran. Any deal must ban all enrichment of uranium and dismantle the equipment and the infrastructure that allows you to enrich in the first place, Netanyahu told the annual conference of presidents of major American Jewish organizations. It should also require that all enriched uranium leave Iran, restrict Iran's ballistic missile program, and impose sustained inspections of Iran's civilian nuclear program, he said. Middle East experts have said Iran is unlikely to agree to all of Israel's demands, and it views them as a breach of Tehran's ability to defend itself. Khamenei, in recent days, has resisted signing a deal, arguing in social media posts that Tehran has the right to produce nuclear power and the range of its missile arsenal should not be limited. He also has taunted U.S. officials. The Americans constantly say that they've sent a warship toward Iran, he said in one message Tuesday. Of course, a warship is a dangerous piece of military hardware. However, more dangerous than that warship is the weapon that can send that warship to the bottom of the sea. An extended assault against Iran could mark the most significant action in decades against the longtime U.S. adversary. For years, Iran has sponsored and facilitated attacks on U.S. troops across the region. U.S. officials broadly agree. Trump began pondering new strikes against Iran in January after he pledged to rescue anti-government protesters there following a wave of executions. The president tabled military action, in part because U.S. defense officials warned it would be difficult to manage Iranian counterattacks while a relatively limited number of U.S. forces were in the region, people familiar with the matter said. The administration has since surged U.S. weaponry, including another aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, that was diverted from the South China Sea. Each carrier has dozens of fighter jets aboard, and numerous Navy destroyers and other warplanes also have been deployed, including advanced F-35s with the ability to evade radar. A review of flight tracking data in recent days has shown a fleet of tanker planes also relocating to Europe and the Middle East, and many fighter jets repositioned at Muwafaq al-Salti Air Base in Jordan. Other U.S. military aircraft appear to have relocated to or transited through Vrazhdebna Air Base in Bulgaria, data show. The military buildup signals the Trump administration is prepared for something much more extended than a one-day cycle of strikes, said Dana Struhl, a former senior Pentagon official during the Biden administration, who is now with the Washington Institute. An extended conflict would mark a sea change from Trump's recent military forays, including the January U.S. Special Operations raid to capture Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in Caracas, a weeks-long bombing campaign last spring against Houthi rebels in Yemen, and the surgical strikes last year against Iran's nuclear facilities. In each of those cases, Trump authorized significant military action that was significant in scope but limited in duration, declared victory afterward, and pivoted to other issues. Trump has criticized previous U.S. administrations for allowing the United States to become entrapped in lengthy military interventions in the Middle East that killed thousands of U.S. troops and dominated Pentagon resources. A lack of calamities during those previous operations has made it easy to overlook the potential pitfalls of future missions, said Jason Dempsey, a retired Army officer who studies the use of military force for the Center for New American Security. They include lethal attacks against U.S. troops, aircraft collisions, and U.S. pilots being forced to parachute or crash behind enemy lines. Military operations look quick and easy right until they are not, Dempsey said. What we did in Venezuela was such a unique operation and a one-off, and even that, I'm not sure it will turn out fine. Commission, packed with Trump allies, approves White House ballroom project. By Jonathan Edwards and Dan Diamond. A federal arts commission on Thursday voted to approve President Donald Trump's planned White House ballroom, even as a federal judge considers whether to halt the project. And outside architects and watchdog groups say it's too large. The Commission of Fine Arts, which Trump has packed with allies, including his 26-year-old executive assistant, voted unanimously to approve the design of the nearly 90,000-square-foot building, which would be the most significant change to the White House complex in decades. This is a facility that is desperately needed for over 150 years, and it's beautiful, Commission Chair Rodney Mims Cook, Jr. said. The Thursday's vote was the first concrete checkpoint in the Trump administration's 9-week push to get the president's ballroom building approved by two committees charged by Congress with reviewing designs of federal construction projects. Having secured the Fine Arts Commission's blessing, the president's team will turn its attention to the second of those committees, the National Capital Planning Commission, with a goal of winning its approval in the first week of March and starting above-ground construction on the ballroom as early as April. Shalom Bahrains, the lead architect on the project, also presented his...
I'm back, and you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. LAB would like to thank you, Mass Lowell's WUML-FM, for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. Today in history, Friday, February 20th, in 2003, a fire sparked by pyrotechnics broke out during a concert by the group Great White at the Station Nightclub in West Warwick, Rhode Island, killing 100 people and injuring about 200 others. Also on this date in 1792, President George Washington signed an act creating the United States Post Office Department. In 1862, William Wallace Lincoln, the 11-year-old son of President Abraham Lincoln and First Lady Mary Todd Lincoln, died at the White House, apparently of typhoid fever. In 1905, the U.S. Supreme Court in Jacobson v. Massachusetts upheld 7-2 compulsory vaccination laws intended to protect the public's health. In 1907, President Theodore Roosevelt signed an immigration act which included idiots, imbeciles, feeble-minded persons, epileptics, insane persons from being admitted to the United States. Well, how did our president get here? In 1938, Anthony Eden resigned as British Foreign Secretary following Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain's decision to negotiate with Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. In 1942, Lieutenant Edward Butch O'Hare became the U.S. Navy's first flying ace of World War II by shooting down five Japanese bombers while defending the aircraft carrier USS Lexington in the South Pacific. In 1950, the U.S. Supreme Court in United States versus Rabinowitz ruled 5-3 that authorities making a lawful arrest did not need a warrant to search and seize evidence in an area that was in the immediate and complete control of the suspect. In 1962, astronaut John Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth as he flew aboard Project Mercury's Friendship 7 spacecraft, which circled the globe 3 times in a flight lasting 4 hours and 55 minutes and 23 seconds before splashing down safely in the Atlantic Ocean 800 miles southeast of Bermuda. In 1965, American Ranger 8 spacecraft crashed on the moon as planned after sending back thousands of pictures of the lunar surface. In 1971, the National Emergency Warning Center in Colorado erroneously ordered the U.S. radio and TV stations off the air. Some stations heeded the alert, which was not lifted for about 40 minutes. In 1987, a bomb left by Unabomber Ted Kaczynski exploded behind a computer store in Salt Lake City, seriously injuring store owner Gary Wright. Soviet authorities released Jewish activist Yosef Begun. In 1999, movie reviewer Gene Sickle died at a hospital outside Chicago at the age of 53. In 2009, President Barack Obama warned a gathering of mayors at the White House that he would call them out if they wasted the money from his massive economic stimulus plan. The Dow Jones Industrial Average ended the week at 7,365.67, the lowest level in more than 6 years. Israeli President Shimon Peres chose Benjamin Netanyahu to form a new government. The WTA fined Dubai tennis championship organizers a record $300,000 after Israeli player Shahar Peer was denied a visa by the United Arab Emirates. In 2014, protesters advanced on police lines in the heart of the Ukrainian capital of Kiev, prompting government snipers to shoot and kill scores of people. In Sochi, Canada beat the U.S. 3-2 in overtime to win its fourth straight Olympic women's hockey gold. Adelina Sotonova became Russia's first gold medalist in the women's Olympic figure skating, defeating defending champion Yuna Kim of South Korea. In 2018, students who survived the Florida school shooting traveled to Tallahassee to urge state lawmakers to prevent another massacre. But procedural moves in the legislature effectively halted any effort to ban assault-style rifles like the one used in the attack. President Donald Trump directed the Justice Department to move to ban devices like the rapid-fire pump stocks used in Las Vegas massacres. Canadians Tessa Virtue and Scott Mayer became the most decorated figure skaters in history, capturing the gold medal in ice dancing on day 11 of the Winter Olympics in South Korea. Okay, Cuban families receive Made in Mexico essentials. Guillermo Beltran walked away with two heavy bags on Thursday, each containing an essential haul: rice, beans, amaranth, and crackers, completed by a bottle of oil, large cans of sardines, and canned peaches. Every label carried the same simple phrase, Made in Mexico. Beltran, a 70-year-old Cuban father of two, was one of several hundred recipients of Mexican humanitarian assistance ordered by President Claudia Sheinbaum in support of the island nation as it faces blackouts and severe fuel shortages worsened by a U.S. oil embargo. "I feel very grateful," said Beltran. "The Mexican president should be praised to the skies for showing such concern and courage." Mexican Navy ships laden with humanitarian aid docked in Cuba last week after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to impose tariffs on the countries that sell oil to the island, depending on already severe economic and energy crises in the deepening in an already severe economic crisis in the Caribbean nations. The ship brought about 800 tons of goods, and another 1,500 tons of powdered milk and beans are expected to be loaded in the coming days. The Cuban government said the aid will support vulnerable families with underweight children or elderly members in Havana and the province of Mayabeque and Artemisa. Earlier this week, state television aired footage of supplies arriving at bodegas, the state-run shops that distribute basic goods to citizens through a national ration book system. The bags received by Beltran were taken directly to his home by the manager of his neighborhood bodega in Havana. "People are very grateful for these donations," Roberto Roman, the 28-year-old manager, told the Associated Press. He's responsible for 1,780 customers distributed among 850 families. The economic crisis gripping Cuba since 2020 has been compounded by intensified U.S. sanctions aimed at forcing a change in the island's political model. These pressures led to critical shortages and severe blackouts that peaked in early 2026. Cuba relied heavily on an oil shipment from Venezuela that were halted when the U.S. attacked the South American country in early January and arrested its leader. Because Cuba produces only 40% of its required fuel, it remains highly vulnerable to external blockades. While strong allies like Russia and China have condemned U.S. measures, their support has remained largely symbolic thus far. Okay. Hold on for 1 second. Police looking for missing person find three men dead in a Detroit house. Oh, God. Police looking for a missing person found the bodies of three men in a Detroit house, authorities said Thursday. The victims, aged 65, 66, and 72, were bludgeoned and stabbed late Tuesday or early Wednesday, Assistant Police Chief Charles Fitzgerald said. "It was a brutal scene inside, just awful," he said. A motive was not immediately known. Investigators were seeking tips and searching for a suspect. The gentleman that lived in that location opened up opened up his house to a lot of folks. They come and go, Fitzgerald told reporters. Unfortunately, there has been some speculation that possibly some drugs were being used in the location, but we can't confirm that at this point. The victims were left in the basement area covered in dirty clothes. One person was covered with a carpet. A neighbor, Thomas Barnes, said one man was a veteran who suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder. Barnes is the president of his block club, which has had a recent name change. It's now called Harmony Village, Barnes told the Detroit News. Ironic, huh? That's sad. Okay, so this is all stuff from the Associated Press now. Judge orders takeover of health care in Arizona prisons. A federal judge has ordered a takeover of health care operations in Arizona prisons and will appoint an official to run the system after years of complaints about poor medical and mental health care. The decision on Thursday by the U.S. District Judge Roslyn Silver came after her 2022 verdict that concluded Arizona had violated prisoners' rights by providing inadequate care that led to suffering and preventable deaths. Silver wrote that the state hadn't gotten a semblance of compliance with court order changes and the Constitution after nearly 14 years of litigation, saying this approach has not failed completely, but if it's continued, would be nothing short of judicial indulgence of deeply entrenched unconstitutional conduct. The judge said prisoners will remain exposed to an intolerable grave and immediate threat of continuing harm and suffering because the systemic deficiencies pervade the administration of health care. The Associated Press left a message for the Corrections Department after the order was issued. The state and attorneys representing prisoners have 60 days to submit a list of candidates to run health and mental health care operations in prisons. This decision means that an independent authority will be able to implement the systemic changes necessary to ensure that medical and mental health care meets constitutional standards, said David Fathy, one of the lawyers representing the prisoners. This is a life-saving intervention, and it brings hope that the preventable suffering and deaths that have haunted Arizona's prison system for over a decade can finally end. Lawyers for the prisoners say Arizona has made few improvements since the verdict and asked the judge for the more drastic remedy of creating such a receivership, arguing systems remain broken and prisoners who need care are still in danger. For over a decade, state government has been dogged by criticism that its health care system for the 25,000 inmates in Arizona's state-run prisons was run shoddily and callously. The state had voted to overhaul medical and mental health services for prisoners in a 2014 settlement, but was soon accused of failing to keep many of those promises. That led to $2.5 million in contempt of court fines against the state and eventually the revocation of the agreement by Silver, who explained that corrections officials had shown little interest in making the changes. The judge then ruled against the state at a 2022 trial, issuing an injunction requiring correction authorities to fix the constitutional violations. While attorneys for prisoners say that the state lacks the leadership to comply with a reasonable amount of time, the corrections department said it has transformed the prison health care system over the last 2 years, such as expanding access to treatments, increasing staff, and opening medical housing units. Correction officials say the opposing side refuses to acknowledge their progress and focus on the reputation and circumstances of the past rather than recognizing or even supporting the good work of the present. Lawyers for the department says the agency's leadership has been acting in good faith with court orders. In September of 2019, lawyers representing the prisoners made a similar request for a takeover, but shied away from it, saying she would revive that possibility of the state acts in bad faith or fails to comply with the court-ordered changes. Past receiverships have been ordered for prisons in other states. In California in 2005, a federal judge seized control of the prison medical system after finding that an average of one inmate a week was dying of medical neglect or malpractice. The Arizona lawsuit does not cover the nearly 10,000 people incarcerated in private prisons for state convictions. All right, Mexico and El Salvador make big cocaine seizures at sea. The navies of El Salvador and Mexico announced drug seizures in the Pacific Ocean this week of more than 10 tons of cocaine, in contrast to deadly strikes by the U.S. government that just this week left 11 people dead on three boats suspected of carrying drugs in Latin American waters. The latest announcement came Thursday when Mexico said it had seized nearly 4 tons of suspected drugs and detained three people from a semi-submersible craft 250 nautical miles south of the port of Manzanillo. Mexican Security Secretary Omar Garcia Harfuch said via X that the seizure from the sleek, low-riding boat with three visible motors brought the weekly total to nearly 10 tons, but he did not provide detail on the other seizures. Mexican authorities said the seizures was made with the intelligence shared U.S. Northern Command and the U.S. Joint Interagency Task Force South. On Sunday, El Salvador's Navy announced the largest drug seizure in the country's history of 6.6 tons of cocaine. The Navy had intercepted a 180-foot boat registered to Tanzania, 380 miles southwest of the coast. Navy divers found 330 packages of cocaine hidden in the boat's ballast tanks. 10 men were arrested from Colombia, Nicaragua, Panama, and Ecuador. On Thursday, Salvadorian authorities gave access to the seized ships FMS Eagle, which had just arrived in the port of La Union. More than 200 wrapped bundles were lined up on the deck. The Trump administration has pressured Mexico to make more drug seizures over the past year. The trafficking of drugs like fentanyl was the president's justification for tariffs on Mexican imports. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum has responded with a more aggressive stance toward drug cartels than her predecessor. That has included sending dozens of drug trafficking prisoners to the United States for prosecution. Sheinbaum has also expressed her disagreement with strikes by the U.S. military in the Caribbean Sea and Pacific Ocean against boats suspected of carrying drugs. At least 145 people have been killed in those strikes since the U.S. government began targeting those it calls narco-terrorists last September. The U.S. strikes this week included two vessels carrying four people each in the eastern Pacific Ocean and another boat in the Caribbean carrying three people. The administration provided images of the boats being destroyed, but not evidence they were carrying drugs. Figures. Okay, let's skip that article. Low connectors rehab long overdue. Built in the 1960s and opened in October of 1962, the Lowell connector never lived up to its potential. There were plans to extend the connector through the city's back central neighborhood up to and along the Concord River, then onward into the downtown at Merrimack Street. Beyond that, there were discussions about extending the connector to the juncture of Route 213 through Drake. However, those ambitious plans came to a screeching halt after it was decided they'd be too disruptive to one of the oldest parts of the city. That left the roadway terminating abruptly at the foot of Gorham Street, where the screeching of tires has become commonplace, often heralding serious, sometimes fatal motor vehicle accidents. But in the near future, road refinements will put an end to the connector's crash-prone association. By 2030, vehicles existing that stretch of road will do so via a rotary rather than a dangerous T-shaped intersection. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation imparted that information during a virtual public hearing held February 11th. Aside from removing the potential for accidents, the revamped exit will improve traffic flow around the congested area. 80% of the funds for the $11 million construction project will flow from the Federal Highway Administration, with MassDOT picking up the remaining 20%. Other ancillary costs, including public and private right-of-way acquisitions, will fall on the city of Lowell. Currently, the design plan indicates a total of 25 properties impacted, which includes three fee-take markings, 5 permit easements, and 29 temporary easements required. The property owners impacted by the municipal portion of this project will be contacted by the City of Lowell officials, said Rosemary Scrivens, MassDOT Right-of-Way Community Compliance Agent. Scrivens said property owners are entitled to appraisal reviews, and such compensation for the impact of the project on their properties. 10 years in the making, the genesis of this project occurred in January of 2016 with a notice to proceed with preliminary design, followed by a safety audit that June. The first public hearing was held in 2018. Excuse me. The reconfiguration traffic design has an anticipated fall 2027 completion date, with construction expected to take approximately 2 years, starting in the spring of 2028. Aside from the rotary, the project will revamp Gorham Street to provide 2 11-foot travel lanes, one in each direction, and 2 bike lanes. And the traffic signal at the intersection of Gorman and Highland Street, Elm Street, will also be upgraded. While its true Lowell connector fell short of becoming a direct link to Interstate 93, these upgrades will at least put its reputation as an accident waiting to happen in the rearview mirror. The Massachusetts Registry of Motor Vehicles celebrated President's Day by announcing a special low-number lottery featuring the state's new 250th anniversary plate. Residents have until 5 p.m. on Friday, April 17th, to apply for that special distinction. The lottery winners will be announced on May 7th online via the RMV website. Further information is available at mass.gov/MA250plate. The Massachusetts 250 Year of Independence plate is emblematic red, white, and blue, and is now the most popular specialty plate in the Commonwealth, with more than 57,000 issued in just over 7 months. The plate features a black background with the year 1776 surrounded by 13 stars and the phrase 250 years of independence at the bottom. There are 1,000 plates available through the lottery, numbered from 1 to 99, including the symbolic 1776. Massachusetts is a state of many firsts, and it's only appropriate that we celebrate the nation's 250th anniversary, honoring our shared history with the opportunity to celebrate civic pride with commemorative low-number license plates through a lottery. Excuse me. Said Philip Eng, interim MassDOT secretary and MBTA general manager. The RMV is thrilled to partner with the Massachusetts State Lottery and benefit from their lottery expertise. And thank you to the RMV team for their incredible efforts in planning this event. Shared Registry of Motor Vehicles Registrar Carlene Ogilvy. This event represents a unique opportunity to combine historical recognition with public engagement in a way that aligns with the lottery's mission, said Massachusetts State Lottery Executive Director Mark William Bracken. Applicants for the special 250th anniversary plate low number lottery will be available at My RMV Online Service Center, located under the plates button. Those wishing to apply must be Massachusetts residents with a current active Massachusetts registered and insured passenger motor vehicle. Applicants can make requests for specific plate numbers. Plates will be awarded using an electronic random number generator system. There's no fee to apply for the lottery. All special plates have a biannual $40 special plate fee, along with a registration of $60. The initial registration fee may vary depending on the applicant's current plate expiration date and expiration date of the winning plate number. Customers are encouraged to visit the registrar's website or follow MassRMV on X for additional plate lottery updates. Lottery plate applicants will be sent notification from the RMV to the email address they provide on the lottery event details. I want 444. Okay. An end of an era. Lowell's Club Diner owner ready to retire. Okay. Lowell. If the walls of the club diner could talk, they would tell the story of Lowell for the last century as people came through its doors after a factory shift, a night of bar hopping, or for a quick bite to eat before work. Owner David Lavassier has seen and heard it all, but after working as a second-generation diner owner for almost his entire life, the 85-year-old is ready to retire. It has put the building at 145 Dutton Street, its contents, and land, it all sits up for sale. A local realtor, Ray Boughton, is the listing agent. Everything's going, Lavassier said, gesturing from the jukebox by the front entrance to the industrial-sized coffee machines that hold 6 gallons of coffee dispensed through the pull-lever nozzles. He gave the son a tour of the diner Wednesday morning. The vintage Worcester lunch car, designed by the Worcester Diner Company, was placed on its current site by Arthur Turcott in 1933 before being taken over a couple of years later by Harry Friedman, the proprietor of the Red Tavern in Methuen. Friedman reopened the club diner as Lowell's most luxurious and newest diner, Lavassier said. He ran it for a couple of years and sold it to my father in 1938. Emile Lavassier was born in Lowell, but his family immigrated from Montreal, part of the French-Canadian exodus to the Mill City that took place from 1860 to 1900. The family of nine, parents Blanche and Emile, David, his four sisters, and two brothers, all work shifts after school during the week, as well as Saturday and Sunday. Back then, the club diner was a 24-hour operation that ran three shifts, leading Lowell's blue and white-collar workforce. Lowell was booming at the time, Lavassier said, and there were factories and all kinds of businesses. When his father died in 1962, Lavassier took a break from his pre-dental studies at Oklahoma State University and came home to run the diner. He reconnected with his high school sweetheart, Elaine McHugh, and started a family. Running the diner was a round-the-clock responsibility, but Lavassier said the customers kept the work interesting. Celebrities would come in here at night, he said. One night, Johnny Cash, the man in black, came in. He sat at the corner with his back to the room. Pictures of Senator Ted Kennedy and Paul Tongass lined the walls, along with photos of former staff. As a kid, David Pelchat ate at the club diner with his friends and said the wait staff ruled the floor with tough love. He ended up working both the front and back of the house and is now the bookkeeper for the business. The club diner holds a lot of memories for many Lowellians, including Michaela Hondros McCarthy, who called the diner a rite of passage growing up in Lowell. Since it was open late, it was the best place to go after the bars for some omelets and home fries with toast, she said, by text Wednesday. You'd walk in, see some friendly, familiar faces, and maybe hear some heckling, sit at a table with friends and laugh about the night while heckling whoever else you knew that would happen to walk through the glass door next. Like Pelchat, Doris McCarthy remembers both the food and the wait staff. If you got too loud, Rita, the best no-nonsense server, would tell you to pipe down with a half a smile, she said. The diner with Lavassier's father, expanded and remodeled in 1960, holds 100 people. By definition, diners are prefabricated structures with counter service. Besides the counter that runs the length of the dining car, deuce booths, or tables for two, sit along the windows in front of the counter section, while four tops fill out the addition at the back of the building. Simple food preparation took place on the main floor, but the fully kitted out basement was where Lavassier said the heavy cooking took place, like the meat, chicken, and fish dishes. Those plates were loaded on the still-functioning hand-cranked dumbwaiter and sent upstairs for tableside delivery. Lavassier said he still remembers the hundreds of plates of fish that went up the dumbwaiter on Fridays when practicing Catholics abstained from eating meat. A wood-framed door lined the inside with metal functioned as the walk-in cooler, and the space is filled with ovens, fryers, stovetops, and supplies. Dozens of soup ladles dangled from ceiling hooks and stirring spoons filled silver canisters lining the countertops. These days, the diner is only open from 7 to 11:30 a.m., 6 days a week, mostly serving breakfast food. People love the eggs and hash, Lavassier said. He spent many of his childhood shifts, he said, peeling hundreds of potatoes in the basement. There is no third generation interested in carrying on the family business, and Lavassier is ready to move on. But he said some of the people looking at the diner want to preserve its nostalgic history. Some of the people who are interested in purchasing it want to keep it open and improve it. He said they want to keep the Club Diner name. It's a great institution. We wish them well in his retirement. Okay, let's see what else. I'm going to skip over the sports because we all know I hate it. Sorry, guys. All right, let's see what else I can find. Okay. Advice, balancing independence with newfound curiosity. This is Dear Annie. Dear Annie, I need advice about a situation I never expected. I'm 37, single, and mostly happy with my life. Then my new neighbor moved in. He's charming and easy to talk to, and I realized I'm suddenly aware of every interaction, overthinking every glance or comment. He's friendly and sociable. Nothing overt, but I catch myself reading too much into casual gestures. I find myself planning my errands around seeing him, replaying conversations in my head, and feeling a strange mix of excitement and anxiety I haven't felt in a long time. I've always been independent and cautious about letting someone into my life. Now, I'm unsure how to maintain my boundaries while navigating this new connection. I don't want to misread signals or make a move I'll regret, but I also don't want to shut myself off entirely. How do I stay grounded and preserve my independence while figuring out whether this connection is worth pursuing? Signed, Cautiously Curious. Dear Cautiously Curious, you can see where things go without rearranging your life for a potential connection. If he's worth your attention, it will become obvious and mutual without you orchestrating a daily performance. But remember, opening your heart a little doesn't mean losing yourself. Curiosity and caution can coexist, and letting yourself feel something new might just make life a little richer. Next one. Dear Annie, my mother-in-law is 17 years has always had too much stuff in her house, but as the years go by, it's getting worse. Her basement is a memorial of her children's old belongings, tools, and canning jars. Every closet is crammed with jackets and clothes. Her house isn't dirty, per se, but every space, every windowsill is crowded with dried flowers, dust, glass knickknacks, and photos. She's always been this way. Her children are now 50 and 46, both with families of their own. We also lost her husband of 50 years last year. I've tried talking to my husband, explaining that this will eventually become his and his siblings' responsibility, and that it's dangerous for a 75-year-old mother to be living like this. But neither child wants to address it with her. How can we lovingly relay to the woman that she needs to start getting rid of the clutter? We need guidance, and she is a regular reader of your column. Signed, Hoarding Horrors. Dear Hoarding Horrors, what you're describing isn't really clutter. It's about comfort, control, and grief. Your mother-in-law may have always been this way, but after losing her spouse, familiar objects can feel like anchors. Asking her to simply get rid of things is unlikely to land. That's why this conversation needs to come from her children, not you, and it needs to start with safety, not sentiment. Frame it around clear walkways, fall risks, and emergency exits, not what she owns. Start small and concrete, one item, one windowsill, one room at a time, rather than making sweeping demands. This won't be a quick fix, but avoiding it now will only make things harder later. Caring for an aging parent often means pressing gently, even when it's uncomfortable. Okay. Manford and Sons finds a new folk rhythm on the collaborative Prize Fighter. Less than a year since the release of Mumford and Sons' long-awaited fifth studio album, Rushmere, the English folk rock band is back with a sixth Prize Fighter, introspective but still upbeat return to their stomp clap form, now bolstered by new voices. The album finds the band made up of lead singer Marcus Mumford, Ted Duane, and Ben Lovett, alongside many collaborators. Aaron Desner of The National co-produces all 11 tracks. Features from Chris Stapleton, Gigi Perez of Sailor Song, viral fame, Hozier and Gracie Abrams punctuate the album. Brandi Carlile, Phineas, Gavin Garrett, John Bellion, and Justin Vernon of Bon Iver round out the writing credits alongside Desner and the band. Carlile provided the inspiration for the single Rubber Band Man, a banjo and acoustic Qatar set reflection on flexibility and recovering featuring verses from Hozier. Mumford said lyrics from the song came to Carlisle in a dream. Hozier's verse, lyric defense, but sonically open, distills the song's thesis, but don't hold to yourself with hard mortar and stone. Be a rubber band man. Make the water your bones. There are some worthy additions to the band's canon between those features. Begin Again and Stay are fast-paced and earnest, while the poetic closer Clover sees Mumford fall into a lullaby-like pace that sung atop a piano melody recalls the aching movie musical hit Falling Slowly by Glenn Hansard and Margarita Irglova. Conversation with My Son, Gangster Angels, is lyrically competitive but still moving. The feature tracks feel like tent poles for the project, offering unique and memorable takes on the genre when other songs start to blend together. Here, with Stapleton, is the simplest opening the album with a country-tinged guitar and drum forward ballad. Abraham's whispers, song tones add layers to Mumford's on Badlands. The lyrics have a sentiment the two artists likely share, a desire to push limits, running away from a tame life, running away like a wild child. Give me a vision, give me a dime. The collaborative approach reflects the spirit of Mumford & Sons' unique summer tour last year, which saw the group travel by train from Louisiana to Vermont, with dozens of musicians and crew continuing a journey starting during a 2011 version of the Railroad Revival Tour. Stops along the way brought the likes of Nathan Ratliff, Trombone Shorty, Lucius, Chris Thiel, Maggie Rogers, Noah Kahn, and Lainey Wilson, among others. On stage together, they sang a mix of the band's songs, featured guest songs, and other covers. As the band sings together on the uplifting Run Together, but when we run together. When we're apart, we fall apart. Collaboration is king. Prize Fighter by Mumford & Sons, 3.5 stars out of 5. On repeat, Icarus with Gigi Perez, Begin Again. Skip It, Alley Cat, I'll Tell You Everything. For fans of Aaron Dessner's production universe, like Brandi Carlile's Returning to Myself, Laufey's A Matter of Time, Gracie Abrams' The Secret of Us. Okay, I didn't understand any of what I just read. I'm assuming it's all about the music world, but I know nothing of any of these people because I was born in the 60s, so... All right, horoscopes, and then we're going to end today. Aries, March 21st through April 19th. Today, the moon is in your sign, bringing you a bit of extra good luck. However, both Saturn and Neptune are also lined up in your sign, which can make you self-critical or disappointed in yourself for some reason. Secretly, you might have heroic expectations, which are tough to live up to. Tonight, you're blessed. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th. For some reason, you might feel self-critical today. Cut yourself some slack. Saturn's line up with Neptune, and those two planets are so different they don't even like to be in the same sentence. Saturn's reality combined with Neptunian idealism leads to disappointment. Tonight, solitude. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. Fortunately, you look great in the eyes of others because the Sun and Venus are high in your chart, which is flattering to you. Meanwhile, today you might feel disappointed in a friend or a group, or they might be disappointed in you, or everyone's disappointed. This too shall pass. Tonight, friendships. Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. Be careful about judging parents, bosses, or VIPs today, unless you're looking at the face of blatant abuse of authority, because many people feel disappointed in authority figures today. It's just what's happening. Make sure that your expectations are realistic. Tonight, show respect. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. This is the classic day to be disappointed in your ideals as they relate to religion, the government, universities, or any institution where you expect high standards. Today you might feel disillusioned. Perhaps this is a wake-up call to investigate and get more information. Tonight, explore. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. It would be wise to postpone important financial decisions, especially concerning inheritances, shared property, taxes, and debt for another day. Your thinking might be confused today. Give yourself 48 hours to have room for a sober second thought. Tonight, check financial paperwork. Libra, September 23rd through October 22nd. Relationships are important to you because you are a people person. You like to have others in your life. Today, someone close might disappoint you, but perhaps you might ask yourself, did I express my expectations? Unexpressed expectations almost always lead to disappointment. Tonight, listen with sympathy. Scorpio, October 23rd through November 21st. Be gentle with coworkers and customers, because it's easy to jump on someone if you think they made a mistake. Possibly the reverse is true, and someone might be jumping on you today. No one is perfect. We all goof up. Be tolerant and kind, and hope that others will be this way with you. Tonight, get organized. Sagittarius, November 22nd through December 21st. Romance might disappoint you today. Likewise, your relations with your kids might discourage you. In part, this might be because we tend to set the bar too high when it comes to our expectations from others. Yet, when it comes to our own actions, we expect understanding and sympathy. Tonight, relax. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. You can be a perfectionist, a quality that might lead to disappointment in a family member today, or conversely, it might lead to someone being disappointed in you. Excuse me, don't hang up on this. Look for common understanding, common courtesy. Everyone benefits. Tonight, enjoy home and family. Aquarius, January 20th through February 18th. Be careful, because with fiery Mars in your sign, you're pumped. However, Saturn and Neptune are muddying the waters in the part of your chart that influences your thinking and your everyday world. This means even though you're confused, you're still raring to go. Not good. Take a beat. Tonight, conversations. Pisces, February 19th through March 20th. Financial matters or something to do with your possessions or something that you own are subject to confusion today, at least in your mind. Therefore, this is a poor day for you to make important financial decisions, especially buying or selling. Forewarned is forearmed. Tonight, check your money and your possessions. And that will wrap up today's reading of the Sun. Though we would like to thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blinds, LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading services, call LAB at 978-454-5704. Request the free specialized radio receiver. Oh, I just said that. Sorry. You can listen to LAB Radio. Oh my God, it's Friday. Anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website, where you can turn into LAB Radio at LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. This has been Diane. Thank you for listening today. I guess tonight it's going to be quite snowy, for what they're saying, 1 to 3 inches of snow overnight. But tomorrow and Sunday look much better. So if you need to get out, wait till tomorrow. Don't do it today, because you're going to get into snowy traffic, and that's nasty. Whatever you do, be kind to one another and enjoy your weekend. Be safe, and we will see you again on Monday. Thank you.
Named a suspect, and they have not found a match for DNA recovered from other evidence around Guthrie's home. Nano said his team is looking at key elements of the doorbell camera footage, namely what the suspect was wearing, including a backpack, mask, and holster, to help identify them. Still, such hurdles in the case have pushed law enforcement to consider new ways to leverage technology, the pacemaker chief among them, Nanos said. Investigators in the Guthrie family implored potential abductors to consider Guthrie's health conditions and her reliance on daily medications early after her disappearance. Today's show co-host Savannah Guthrie and her siblings said in video messages posted to social media that their mother's heart was fragile and that she needed medicine to survive. That concludes this Friday's reading of the Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been a pleasure to read for you.
You were just listening to the Washington Post on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, mostly cloudy, some rain moving in, possible snow as well, temperatures in the upper 30s. Overnight, chance of rain, cloudy, temperatures in the upper 20s. And for Saturday, mostly cloudy, temperatures in the mid-30s. The sun rose this morning at 6:32, setting at 5:23 this evening. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
This